This is a recording from the Jefferson Society at the University of Virginia. For more information, visit jeffersonsociety.org. On November 16, 2007, the Society hosted Larry Peck, formerly the Vice President for Global Fuels Technology for British Petroleum and the current Chief Operating Officer of Cillian, a new biofuels company. Peck talks about efforts to develop renewable energy sources, and he's introduced by Society Vice President Amro Nadi.
And he is currently, for the last 1.5 months, the Chief Operating Officer of Cillian, a recent alternative energy startup. So please join me in welcoming our speaker.
Short to the point, I'm going to have to go it up. It's all right. Amro, thanks. Thanks also a few of you for the nice dinner tonight before we did this. That was great, very enjoyable, and thanks for having me here this evening. I get a great charge out of doing this. So I have a whole bunch of slides here. If we spend a lot of time on each of these slides, we will never get through. And what I really want to do is just zip through a bunch of this stuff to tee up a lot of things that you might be interested in talking about, and then however long you normally go, we can just talk. Be a lot more fun, I think, if this is more interactive than just a lecture. So, just so you know a little bit more about, you know, who I am and who's standing up here talking. I am a chemical engineer by training. I went to undergraduate school at Purdue in Indiana, and I went to graduate school. I have a PhD in chemical engineering from Princeton a long time ago. Then I went to work for what was then Amoco. Worked for almost 30 years for Amoco, then BP, after BP bought Amoco in 1999. I've worked my whole time there in the part of the oil business that starts with crude oil and makes it into things that people want to buy. So in an oil company, there's the people who find the oil and pump it out of the ground, and then there's the people that make it into products people can use. The second part is where I've worked, and kind of all through all different parts of that is what I've done. And as Amro said, I left BP, actually retired from BP, in the end of the summer, and didn't stay retired real long, and then went to work for this little startup that's being run by a friend that I knew from BP days. And we can talk about that some, too. So it's a company that makes ethanol from corn. So some of you may have heard about that, may have views, pro or con, whatever. We can talk about that if you want. So I just wrote a bunch of things that the slides deal with here is about energy, security, climate, transportation, and kind of biofuels in the end. Talk a little bit about that, so press on. Let's talk about what I would say are the big key drivers of energy future for all of us, not just U.S., but really for the world. There's kind of four big things that are issues when you talk about energy. One is demand growth, which is substantial in the world. One is the challenge of supply. One is environmental issues, and you have both local pollution kinds of things, which in the developed world are pretty much handled. But then you have climate change is the other big issue for environmental. And lastly, you have security of source, which is a big issue if you are in a country where the source is not your country. Right? At the heart of all this is really a lot of technology issues related to each of these. And so this is, underneath it all, a problem that has a lot to do with technology, which is why it was something that I was interested in and worked on a lot. Okay, press on. So let's talk about the demand. That's the top corner there. Demographics. This should be a familiar story to people who've thought about where the world is going. 6.5 billion people now, closer to 7 almost, headed to 8. 8.5, 9, you know, at some projections go out to as high as 13, but you know, the rate of increase is tapering off some. And, of course, most of those people don't live here. The big increases are coming in Asia, you know, India and China in particular. And the developed world is growing much more slowly. Press on. This is a table that has a whole lot of different things that are changing in it, but I think the one I highlighted here is just kind of interesting. This is the number of cities with more than 8 billion people in them by year. In 1950, there were two. 72, there were nine. Recently, there's about 25. By 2050, there'll be 200, most of them in China and India. Okay, that's where the big new cities will be. And China right now is going through a massive urbanization happening at a scale that's unprecedented. Now, when you build cities, the whole energy, way energy is used, distributed, et cetera, is different than people living in the countryside and on farms and agrarian economies. So some big implications there. You can see some other things listed up there in terms of change. Very dramatic change happening to the Earth and our population across the next 50 years. Okay, press on. This is total annual primary energy demand for various parts of the world. So you can see North America, obviously very high compared to everybody else now. And you have the Asia kind of growing up and surpassing, essentially coming in to be the same as us, but the growth rate of energy use there obviously much, much higher. You have Latin America and Europe, very slow growers. Underneath the little empty sign there, it says former Soviet Union. Interesting shape, right? You can see that it went through some tough times where their economies were actually shrinking dramatically and then recently have started to come back a little bit. Enough about that one. Let's press on. This is a subset of energy demand. This is energy demand for mobility, as modeled here just in terms of number of vehicles. So in the U.S. today, just as a part of this number, there's about 200 million cars and trucks in the just in the United States out of the world number there of about 500 million and some in the OECD countries, so we have way more than our share. Not news to people, I'm sure. The other thing that's just interesting to see here is that by 2030, the rest of the world will have caught up. So whereas today there may be a third of the number of vehicles in the developed world, in the rest of the world will be up where we are by 2030. Again, just a stunning and dramatic change in the amount of energy needed for transportation across a relatively short time, as change in the world happens. That's probably enough on that one. Press on. Let's talk a little bit about supply. And so supply of energy sources pretty much comes from oil, gas, and coal. So most of the energy in the world today comes from fossil carbon, and thus it comes from the sun, of course, but it was the sun hundreds of millions of years ago, not now. The oil is the least amount of reserve in oil. If you look at how much we're using today versus how much we know where it is, it's about 40 years worth. But typically, we find more every year, so that 40 doesn't go down by a year every year. So 20 years from now, there still may be 40 years worth. It's based on how much you find over time. So that's why it kind of fuzzes out there at the top. And we typically every year find deposits that we didn't know were there before. So you have unproven or unknown reserves. Natural gas, there's a little bit more. And we use a little bit less per year, so the reserve life is longer. That says 67 years. Not sure it's quite that precise, but on the order of somewhere between 50 and 100. For coal in the world, there is a huge amount of coal in the ground. Hundreds of years worth of coal. So if all you want is energy and you're not real particular about other effects of that energy, there's plenty of coal. It costs a little more to do something with coal to make a liquid fuel. But if you just burn it to make power, there's plenty of it. And then there's other sources, obviously, of energy in the world that we use. So there's uranium that we use for nuclear power. There's sun, wind, and those kinds of things, but those are all actually very, very small in comparison to fossil fuel in terms of how much energy is used around the world. There's some countries, France would be an example, where nuclear is a much higher percentage. Okay. That's interesting. The slide isn't there. It was there on my my own computer. What this is, and I'm sorry the slide doesn't show up on this particular. Oh, there it is. You just have to hit it more. It's one of those building kind of slides. Yeah. This isn't my slide, so somebody who's fancier with PowerPoint than I was made it up. Where the fuel is used versus where the fuel is found is an issue. And so for oil, it's an obvious issue. So 80% of the consumption occurs in the three largest markets, and only 15% of the deposits are in those same countries for oil. Obviously, all the oil deposits, I mean, vast majority of the oil deposits are in the Middle East. Russia is another big source of oil. So places with probably not the most stable of politics. For gas, it's a little better balanced, but still pretty disparate. For coal, it's in the best balance. A lot of coal in the U.S., a lot of coal in China. So coal has that going for it, but it has some other issues. Okay, that's a 2002, so it's a little old, but it hadn't changed a lot since then. Next. So in terms of environmental things, I kind of said very briefly, and I don't even have a slide on it, there's really two kinds of environmental issues around energy. One is pollutants that actually are harmful in a local way when you burn something or make energy. So for tailpipe exhaust out of the car, it's things like carbon monoxide, NOx, sulfur oxides, and unburned hydrocarbons. Those things were a big issue in many parts of this country, for instance, 30 years ago. Today's technology with clean fuels and catalyst on the exhaust of cars, really local pollution has come to be most places not really much of an issue. So you still have some non-attainment areas where there's ozone, smog, those kinds of things, but really compared to years ago, the problems are small, and you can drive those problems down as small as you want. So today, it's most all the pollution in a car happens when you first turn it on before the catalyst gets hot. Those things are solvable for not a lot of money. If you care about the last little bit of pollutants, you can get those out. So that's kind of more political will than it is difficult to deal with. It's how much people care. Climate is the harder one. Okay, so we can talk as long or as short as you want about climate. I'm not a climate scientist. I know just enough to be dangerous, probably. But we can talk about what I do know. This is just some data. And what it's showing is the global mean temperature of the Earth on the top versus time. And on the bottom, it's actually spread out in terms of latitude. So you can see not just the average, but where it is north to south on the globe. And for sure, and without doubt, I mean, there's a few things that are for sure true, and there's some other things that are more conjecture and uncertain. But it is for sure true that for the last 50 years at least, and probably the last 100 years, the Earth has been getting warmer on average. And that is true. Now, if you take the plot back, of course, far enough, it's been getting warmer since Chicago was under 1,000 feet of ice. About 20,000 years ago or whenever that was. So for sure, there are long-term cycles and short-term cycles, and over the longest time of the 4.5 billion years of the age of the Earth, it's slowly cooling off, of course, because it was molten when it was first made. So you have to think about the time scales of all this. But across 100 years, it's for sure getting warmer. Okay, and then the other thing that is for sure true, and I don't have a slide on this in this deck, I probably have one somewhere, is that the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere that is from burning fossil fuel is steadily going up. So if you measure CO2 in the atmosphere and you can tell what kind of CO2 it is by the carbon isotopes, so fossil fuels give a different ratio of carbon 14 than stuff that's from plants and other parts of the cycle today, it's going up. So we are, by our actions, putting more CO2 in the atmosphere, for sure. And the Earth is getting warmer, for sure. So those are two things that are measurable and facts. And then what you have is models that try to explain why and are those things related to each other or not. Okay? And I think maybe the next slide, let's try. Yeah, this isn't real good. It doesn't show up real clearly here. But the amount of carbon that goes to CO2 that's associated with our activities as humans is about 5 gigatons per annum. In numbers that are churning through on the order of hundreds of gigatons, so like 5% or less of the total flux of all these big amounts of carbon that are put into the atmosphere, taken back out of the atmosphere, put into plants, released from plants, you know, all the different fluxes of the carbon cycle for the whole Earth. And to figure out whether or not it's our CO2 that's making the temperature go up, you have to build a big model, a computer model, basically, of the climate of the Earth. And people have been working on that for a long time, and you know, there's people who've devoted their lives to being able to model the climate. The vast majority of those people working in those fields today believe the models are saying that our CO2 is at least a major driver, not the only driver, but a major driver of the temperature change. There are people who believe that's not true. Okay, and so you can go out in the scientific literature and you can find people on both sides. You'll find more people on the side saying, yeah, it's us, than people on the other side. And there's some good arguments on both sides that I've read. It's not my field, but when you read things, this is not easy. The science of this is not easy, and in being not easy, I would say it's also uncertain. So exactly where the temperature is going to go, exactly how much CO2 you have to stop putting out to make it stop going up, and those kinds of questions are, the answers are relatively difficult. And it, you know, my impression, you guys can tell me what you all think, my impression is it has gotten to be an issue where having a rational inquiry-based conversation is getting more and more difficult. And so people have their position, and without having read the scientific literature themselves, are very sure that they know the right answer. You know, I've read some of the literature, not nearly all of it, and I'm really pretty sure I don't know the right answer. But that's the science. And then you have the question around, well, if we're not sure, maybe we should do something just in case it is where I think a lot of people come down and say, you know, don't bother me with the science anymore. If it could be, then I think we need to fix it. It is, though, a big problem because all this energy that we're using today, most all of it comes from burning some form of carbon. And all that carbon goes to CO2 in the atmosphere. And the cycle time of the fluxes that change out how much CO2 is in the atmosphere is roughly on the order of 100 years, about a century. So stuff we're putting up today will on the order be 100 years there. And if we stop putting any up today, you know, the decay period is like 100 years before it goes back to how it was. So it's a very long time. And also because it's a 100-year kind of thing, if you put twice as much in now, you know, it means you have to take that much more out later across 100 years if you want to have a fixed amount. So it's kind of like a big bucket. You know, the more we put in the bucket today, the less we can put in the bucket for the next decade and the next decade. So it's a long time constant problem to solve. The fact that it's a long time constant and also the fact that it, you know, local pollution, if you live in L.A., local pollution was a big issue in L.A. And so California really early got on the political road to cleaning up cars, and they cleaned up their air. And the people who lived there could make that happen. Right? For us, in looking at the climate, of course, if the CO2 gets emitted in Chicago or Washington or Beijing or Buenos Aires or anywhere, it doesn't matter. Right? It's all the same CO2. It's all the same atmosphere. So it isn't a local problem. And if I contribute my part to solving it and somebody else doesn't, it still doesn't get solved. Right? The other thing is with a decade or century-type timescale, it isn't a terribly good fit with our political time cycle of like 2 to 4 years. It was about how long politicians pay attention to things, because a lot of them are gone after 2 to 4 years. To me, this is an incredibly difficult problem. Incredibly difficult. Technically, though, it's maybe not that hard. I mean, if you really wanted to do something about it, it's probably not that hard. It's expensive, but it's not that hard to figure out what to do. Move on from that one. So how are we doing? I mean, a whole bunch of people signed up to fix this problem. This is Kyoto, right? So we have the Kyoto signatories. And they say, how are we doing on fixing living up to the treaties? So if you look over here, you know, these are the countries that are putting out more, not less, right? And over there is the countries that are putting out less. So, you know, Spain, Monaco, Portugal, Greece, I know you can't read these, I can't, Ireland, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. I mean, these are all the people that signed on. Not doing too well yet, okay? You say, well, maybe it's early days. But there's some people over here doing great, right? Who are these people? They're doing really well. You know, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Bulgaria, Ukraine, right? So why are they doing so well? Right? Because their economies went all to hell, right? Basically. So what that is more a measure of than anything is relative economic growth over that period. There's a couple of countries that are a little bit outliers. Actually, United Kingdom has done pretty well across the past 10 years, and they have done that mostly because they have replaced an awful lot of coal-fired power generation with gas, and natural gas emits a lot less carbon than coal when you burn it. But, you know, not looking like a lot of progress, despite being signed on to by most countries. Okay, let's go on. So where's all these greenhouse gases, all this CO2 come from? And maybe I should stop first and make sure everybody's aware. You know, CO2 is one of the gases that cause heat to be trapped in the atmosphere. There are others, and there are some, like methane, that is actually much, much more effective per molecule than CO2 is. But CO2 is the one that is increasing dramatically these days, and so that's really what we pay attention to here. In terms of where it comes from, far and away the most of the stuff that we do comes from power generation, so making electricity. You have industry, a lot of that's buildings, a lot of it's consumed in, you know, making steel, aluminum, things like that. Transport, actually buildings got separated out here, sometimes that's put in the industry. And then you have some that are actually not related to energy at all. So you have, you know, where you go in and you're cutting down forests to make farmland. You know, all the carbon that's in the wood, that's in the trees, eventually over time tends to wind up in the atmosphere and burned or whatever. And then agriculture itself can release CO2 from the land. So, and those are the things, of course, all the things that are non-energy are some of the things that are in the balance of the climate models you have to worry about, that are change amounts as opposed to just fluxes that are going in and out. So if we look at the next slide, I think is going to be, if we want to reduce the amount of CO2 we're making, what are the ways we can do this most cheaply? So this is a slide that attempts to show the cost of various ways of trying to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide you make to make a given amount of power, of some kind of power. The things on the left are making electric power, and the things on the right, the three bars on the right, are transportation related. And while there's some noise in these, and there's a range of each of them, what you can see is that it's actually a lot less expensive to reduce CO2 make by doing it for power generation than it is to do it for transportation. So transportation is a more expensive place to try to reduce CO2 creation than it is to do it in power. And in some cases, you know, power is actually a relatively inexpensive way to do it. Nuclear, very efficient, and of course, nuclear makes no CO2 at all. Photovoltaics, depending on how well the sun shines where you are, is very expensive. Right? So solar PV is the really high bar for power. Solar is really expensive. This second bar here, probably these are hard to read. Hydrogen for power, it says C and S. That's about taking something like coal and burning it, but then you can take the result of that burning and you get a gas as a result of that. You add water to that gas and you take and essentially shift the equilibrium to where you make as much hydrogen as you can in that synthesis gas or syngas. And then you can take the CO2 that's left and put it in the ground. So now we do that today. Oil companies use today CO2 to push oil out of the ground. And so that's one place you can put it. You can put it in aquifers or deep below impermeable places. And at least theoretically, it'll be down there for way more than 100 years, which is our time constant that we're worried about. Right? So if you can capture the CO2 from a combustion process and sequester it so it doesn't get to the atmosphere, that is a way to make power and not make CO2. It doesn't look to be terribly expensive. It's more expensive than just venting the CO2 to the atmosphere, so someone has to care enough to pay a little more to not have the CO2 go out the stack. And today, really there's no pricing mechanism for CO2. So there's talk about caps and trades and taxes and whatever else, but the reality is there's no value to doing this. BP actually had a project like this that was moving along and that was canceled about a year ago to build a plant just like that, to make hydrogen, use the hydrogen to make electricity, take the CO2 and put it back in a field up off the coast of Scotland. And the economics just weren't there without government support or mandates or something to cause an incentive, and there wasn't a mandate or support, and so we didn't do it. And so, businesses in the end, of course, are in business to make money. That's what we do. So we aren't philanthropic. And so we had to give that one up. There's another one that's not as far along in the process that we're actually looking at doing in California. And it will take petroleum coke, which is a lot like coal, out of the refinery that we have there, gasify that, and there's a place off the coast of California to put the CO2. That one might happen, especially if California puts in some CO2 limits, which they certainly are trying. Wind is not bad, little expensive. Wind is very intermittent, though, so when the wind doesn't blow, it's a problem. And so wind is great as a place where you have a whole lot of generating capacity and spare capacity so that you can turn your boilers up if the wind stops blowing. But if you need a constant amount of electricity, wind by itself isn't that helpful. The ones on the right are transportation. The three bars, you have hybrids. Hybrids are a pretty good route, actually. They cost a little more than power, but a hybrid, especially in the city, if you have stop-and-go traffic, is a much more efficient vehicle than a regular internal combustion alone. And the hybrids we have today are kind of just a step one or step two of where they could go. So there's a lot of good technology yet to come, I would say, from hybrids, including plug-in hybrids that you can fill off the grid at nighttime when the electricity demand's low. Those will come. And if you're, especially, again, in stop and go, it's really great. If you're driving a long distance, from Chicago to D.C., it doesn't really help you much, because the demand is constant for that kind of a trip, so you don't get any regenerative energy back in the battery. The second bar there is biofuels, and so we can talk a little bit more about biofuels. But biofuels, things that you make a liquid fuel from a biological source of some kind, the carbon that's in the biological source is not fossil carbon. It's carbon that the plant or animal pulled out of the air in the first place. So it's just going back where it came from, so it doesn't change the amount of CO2 in the air over time. As long as you just reuse the same stuff with the same plants over and over again, so you grow new plants, they pull the CO2 out, you burn the plants, that puts the CO2 back, but as long as you cycle it, no net change. Really high level, good theoretical way to think about it, the devil's in the details. but it can work. The one way over there on the right is the one that a lot of people like to talk about, which is hydrogen for transport. So fuel cell cars. You see a lot about that in the press. It's kind of an exciting technology. It is a stunningly expensive way to try to get CO2 out of the atmosphere, mostly because hydrogen itself has to be made from something. We can't drill a hydrogen well. Right? There is no naturally occurring hydrogen by itself anywhere except the sun. So you have to make it, and to make it, you have to put in energy to get the hydrogen away from the oxygen. So hydrogen on this planet exists in the form of mostly water, right? H2O, with the exception of the hydrogen that's in fossil fuels or plants. So to make that hydrogen, you have to put energy in. And that in itself is an inefficient process. And then you get more inefficiencies built on inefficiencies. And then the whole thing is actually stunningly expensive when you're done. It sounds cool. And the technologies are cool. If you're an engineer, working on fuel cell cars and all that is fun and exciting. But if you want to solve the problem, it isn't going to get us there fast or affordably. And of course, if you make the hydrogen from power that you made from coal, you're actually not helping yourself very much. You got to make the hydrogen from like nukes or solar or something, or you're really not gaining much ground at all. So that just tells you a little bit about how hard it is to solve. Now let's move in then to transport. So what I would say is, my view, certainly it would be the view of BP where I used to work and applies to this new company where I work now as well. The logic of the fact that it would be way cheaper just to do this with power isn't going to mean that transport gets a free ride. I mean, if we were a centrally managed economy and somebody could just check off what to do, then you might do it that way. Reality is the politics will drive us to have to do something with cars as well, cars and trucks. No question, I would say. And so where's the CO2 from in transport and how are we going to get at that is still an important question. And, of course, when you're a fuel company, which is what oil companies for the most part are fuel companies, this is a really important question. You can see here that, I've taken now the non-energy things have come out of this pie, so the farming and those kinds of things. So this is just all the man-made CO2, power generation, domestic and commercial industry and transportation, and transportation's about a fifth of the total energy use. If you look at what that is, it's almost all road. So yeah, air does some, marine does some, rail does some, but it's almost really all cars and trucks is where the big lever is. The one that's growing the fastest is air, interestingly, but it's still small. And if we're going to make a big difference, then you got to make a big difference with cars and trucks. And that's today, of course, they're all internal combustion, gasoline, diesel. Let's press on. So if we want to fix this, here's a little plot that just has on it the two axes that we talked about worrying about. So this is maybe a little complicated, but you've got, if you're real concerned or not very concerned on the left about supply and security. So if you remember, one of the things I said was, coal actually is where the people who want the power live. So if you're really concerned about security, coal looks pretty good, right? I don't have to get coal from Iraq. I can get coal from Montana. It's a much easier problem. So coal, and this up here is coal to liquids. So you can take coal and you can make liquid fuel out of coal. There's different ways to do that, but probably the most famous way is called Fischer Tropsch, but after Herr Dr. Fischer and Herr Dr. Tropsch, who worked for Germany during World War II. So that's the gasoline for Messerschmitts came from coal in Germany, and the process has been around a long time. You can make gasoline and diesel fuel that way, and there's other ways too. But, as we said, that helps with security. It doesn't help at all with CO2 because all that coal that's turned into liquid fuel is still fossil carbon. When you burn it, it's still going to go in the atmosphere. So that's, you know, this is this way. And, of course, oil falls down here because, you know, security for oil is a big issue. It, almost none of it is where the people live who want it. Left to right, then, is how much concern you have about CO2. So this is kind of old world, you know, where we used to live. When crude oil was $9 and the world wasn't getting warmer, you could live down here. No worries about supply, no worries about climate. Everything's cheap. Nice world. It's the world I grew up in. It was easier. And then there's a lot of different kinds of things you can do. So gas to liquids. Gas is a little better than coal. It has a lot more hydrogen in it and a lot less carbon. So when you make liquids out of that, you make less CO2, more H2O. These are actually different ways of getting oil really out of the ground. CO2 enhanced recovery is putting CO2 down in the ground to push the oil out. So to the extent the CO2 stays down there, you're getting a help. The things that can really help up here in the top right corner, that's what we want, right? We want things that help the climate and help energy security. And there's only a few shown here. You've got vehicle efficiency. One of the things that's just interesting is that if you look at the ability of our cars today to use the energy that's in a gallon of gasoline, it is stunningly more efficient at using that energy than it was in the 1970s. So across 30 years, we've made huge progress in efficiency of engines. Virtually all of it has gone into heavier cars and faster acceleration. Okay? So if you took a car with the performance of a car that you bought in the 1970s, the engine in that car would be much, much, much smaller than the engines that we have today in our cars. But what we have is big, heavy cars with really good acceleration. Because that's what, you know, why do they make those? Because that's what people buy. The car companies make them. The car companies will make whatever people buy. They make Priuses and they make Tundras if you're Toyota. They make Focuses and they make F-150s or whatever if you're Ford. But it's what consumers buy. But lightweighting the vehicles would make a big difference. Now, you could double the mileage of the fleet easily without really affecting people too much, other than the thrill of acceleration. And, you know, I say that snidely, but I have a fast car. So I'm among the people contributing to the problem. Hybrids help a lot. Biofuels, and then way up on the top right is carbon-free electricity for transport. So, you know, if you put your solar cells up or your nuclear plant and you make hydrogen with those, for sure it addresses both those axes, but it's stunningly expensive. Okay? Roll on. Another thing about liquid hydrocarbons for transportation, and this slide is pretty complicated again, but what you've got here is volumetric density and weight density. And what it's really showing you is what you want is something that has a whole lot of energy in it per volume and also doesn't take up a lot of space. So you want it to be dense and you want it to be high energy per volume. And so gasoline is really good. It's way up there on the top right. So there's a huge amount of energy in gasoline per volume and per weight, which is probably why it's used as a transportation fuel. I mean, it's easy to carry around because anything you're using for transportation, you got to bring with you. All the other things, I mean, look at batteries, right? So your hybrid electric car, when it's running off the batteries, I mean, batteries are just dismal. So they take up a lot of room. They're really heavy, made out of lead-acid batteries, that is, and they don't hold a lot of energy. Nevertheless, you can make a car that works on them. There's a bunch of things in between there for hydrogen. This is where the folks with liquid hydrogen are trying to get. I mean, the interesting thing that people probably don't know, unless you're a chemist or such, is the amount of hydrogen in a gallon of liquid hydrogen is actually less than the amount of hydrogen in a gallon of gasoline. So gasoline actually is a more efficient way to store hydrogen than is liquefying the hydrogen. It's weird to think about, but it's true. But the problem is, of course, in the gasoline, a lot of carbon comes along with it. Press on. So if we want to get carbon that's not fossil, what are we going to use? That's what this slide's speaking about. gasoline, diesel, coal, this is how much we use of that stuff, other petroleums, NGLs. This is, if you want to use plants, this is how much there is. So if you want to use plants that we're using today, it doesn't get close. The blue bars there. The tallest one is corn. All right, and that's the little company I'm working with now does corn to ethanol. But the other things, there just isn't anything like enough to get even close to 10, 15% of our fuel use. The two on the right, the first short green bar is kind of all other biomass today, so that's like leftover wood from sawmills and things of that sort. The right one is just an estimate of, if you look at the land that's out there that really isn't being used for anything today other than fallow, and you look at how much you might be able to grow of just cellulosic biomass, it's actually a big number. It's actually a big number. So you could, if you wanted to, get to the same order of size of energy content by growing it as we're using today from some of these fossil sources. But it's a lot more than we're doing today, right? So if you look at the difference in the bars, you've got to grow a lot more stuff than we're doing today. And you have to grow it much, much more efficiently and densely, et cetera. Press on. Today's biofuels, basically the big biofuel today is ethanol, and it's used very heavily in Brazil. So if anybody is familiar with what goes on there, they actually sell gasoline or ethanol, and you kind of take your choice, and consumers are used to it, and all the cars run on both, and it's kind of a great success story of a governmental decision made back quite some time ago. In this country, we make ethanol from corn, and it's the same process, essentially, as making beer. So same basic thing. You have yeast, you have corn, it ferments. The ethanol comes out as a byproduct of what the yeast is doing, and then you separate the ethanol out. In Brazil, they make their ethanol from sugar, which is a liquid. I mean, it's a much easier process. It's cheaper. It probably is about half the cost to make ethanol in Brazil out of sugar cane, especially where you're growing it in essentially tropical rainforest-type climate, as it is to make it out of corn here. Both of them, though, can work against, you know, $90 oil like we have today. One of the things you've seen happen here over the past year and a half is the price of corn has gone up dramatically in the U.S. Some of that, for sure, is related to increased use to make ethanol. So questions about biofuels is cost. At some level of cost, they compete with crude oil. Certainly at $90 to $100, they compete. You have infrastructure costs to distribute ethanol. You can't use the pipes and tanks that you have today for gasoline. You have to put in new stuff. So there's a cost. It's not insurmountable. It's in many states, it's already done. Vehicles, the changes to make vehicles work on biofuels can be anywhere from nothing, if the fuel is essentially a hydrocarbon, to things like ethanol. You have to have minor changes in the engine componentry and MAP and injection systems and such. It's not hard. Press on. Materiality, we talked about. You know, is there enough? Can you make a difference? Environmental sustainability. So in all of this, you know, you want to measure actually what's the difference in CO2 from doing this. So you have to plant the crops. You have to harvest the crops. You have to move them to the factory. You have to make the stuff. You have to move the stuff. All that takes some amount of energy, and you got to compare that to drilling the oil well, producing the crude oil, et cetera, and do the math on both those differences. There's a lot of people who've worked hard on that, and there's good numbers for that if you go out in the literature. So you can find the answers. And it can work, but it's what we're doing today isn't where we would need to be. I'll tell you that. Press. Energy balance is an interesting one. So people talk about ethanol and complain about the energy balance. It takes almost as much energy to make a gallon of ethanol as you get from burning the ethanol. And that can be an issue if you're energy short. If you don't care about climate, for instance, and you take the energy from coal and you make ethanol with that, then you've made a liquid fuel out of coal. And for security, that's fine. That's great. But it doesn't help climate. So now if you use nuclear energy for your electricity to run your ethanol plant, then you're better. And there's things you can do to affect those energy balances. Press on. Corn Ethanol, the company I work for now, this is what we do. There's not enough. You couldn't grow enough corn to make a huge difference. You can do maybe up to 10 or 15% of the gasoline pool. That's how much we could blend in and still run all the cars on it. So every car on the road today in the U.S. will run on 10%. Really, all of them will run on 15%, although some of the automakers will whine about it a little bit. But we probably are, you know, right now, you're seeing effects of driving up corn price by how much we're already making. The markets will adjust to that, and eventually that'll equilibrate out and probably won't be as dramatic as you see today, would be my bet. CO2 emission of a bog standard ethanol plant that was built 5 years ago, you only save about 1/5 of the CO2 versus fossil. So some, but it's not much. The plant that the company I work for now that it's building in California is way, way, way more efficient than that in terms of energy use and thus in reduction of CO2. So probably at least twice that. But there is a limit. Ethanol is not a wonderful fuel molecule. It has some issues. You can't run it through pipelines. So all of these things about ethanol are saying, and rightly so, it's a step and it's a start, but it's only that. And there'll have to be a lot of things come along with it and make it better and to really make it matter to help solve the problem. Press on. This is just saying the molecules we'd really like to make. So over there on the right is 2,2,4-trimethylpentane. 2,2,4-trimethylpentane is octane, right? That's hard to make biologically. Methanol, ethanol, easy to make biologically, not good molecules. Next. Biodiesel. Biodiesel works. There's not enough. How's that for a quick slide? You grow all the seed oil seeds you want. It doesn't ever matter. It just doesn't matter. There's not enough. So it's fun. It's cool. Doesn't help. Press on. So the other key to biofuels, of course, is the whole plant side of it. So this is a picture of, on the left is corn, what it started off as before genetic breeding, kind of the old-fashioned way and the new way, and what it looks like on the right, rice and tomatoes. I mean, that really has all been done by man, those changes. Those same kinds of changes can be applied to the plants that we might grow to make energy, and that work is really in its infancy. So I think that's where the big prize is through the application of biological science to this problem of trying to make fuels from biological sources. There's a big, big, big amount of science that isn't applied to that yet that'll help a lot. Next. Just on the right is kind of an interesting plot. That's the average corn yield per acre by year of a farm, you know, an average farm in Indiana. No end in sight, right? Just right on up. So, and that's through breeding, plant breeding, and better agronomy practices. So you can make a lot of progress. Forestry, people haven't worried about it, so it hasn't changed much. Next. Miscanthus is one of the plants people talk about for cellulosic ethanol. You can grow a whole lot of it very densely and grow a lot of mass of plant material in a small space, but you have to have a way to convert that stuff to fuel. Cellulose is much harder. Next. This is just, you can press on. These are just things showing how much progress you can make. This is interesting. These are the same plant, but drought resistant and not through genetic engineering. So you can make a plant that needs a lot less water. And water will be an issue if we're going to grow a lot of biomass. Next. This is just pictures of cellulose. This is why it's really hard to use the cellulose. In corn, you grind the corn up and the starch comes out loose and you can use it. The cellulose is all bundled up and really hard to use. So that's actually engineering along with biology to fix that. Next. This is just more about cellulose. Cellulose is actually sugars that are made with 6 carbon atoms, which is like sugar, and also with 5 carbon atoms, which is not like sugar. And today's bugs like to eat the C6s and not the C5s. So there's, again, genetic engineering of bugs that can help that. Next. There. So that was all my slides. I don't know how long that went, but it seemed like about an hour. And I'm happy then to talk about anything you want to talk about and all that stuff, or other stuff that's on your mind that's related to energy. I mean, we can talk about other things too, but I don't know about them. Yeah.
Thank you for your speech. Is the only reason keeping nuclear energy from being a major fuel source in the United States political? Are those the only reasons behind it, or is it technological, science-wise?
Okay. And I'm supposed to repeat the question because this is going on tape, right? So the question is the only thing that's hindering further use of nuclear power in the U.S. political issues as opposed to technical issues? And to me, it's I'm not sure quite how to, because you can get into a semantic argument about, you know, what's technical, what's political. I mean, the reality is other countries are building nuclear power really quickly today. France is very heavily nuclear. China is building nuclear plants really, really fast. The technology to build good, safe as anything, nuclear plants exists today, and you could build them, and they would be cost competitive with other things, and they don't make any CO2. Issues you face are everything from, you know, NIMBY. You know, I love nuclear, but not next to me, please. You know, put it down the street where I don't have to think about it. So you have problem getting permitted because people don't want it near them. And then you have the issues of the waste. You know, so there is spent fuel when you're done. Spent fuel you have to store for several, you know, thousands of years or however long. There's not a lot, and you can put it somewhere. But again, where can I put it? You know, if I don't live in Nevada, I'd like you to put it in Nevada. That would work for me. So that's a problem. Proliferation is an issue depending on where it's happening. So, you know, you can make uranium-238. You can make bombs, plutonium. So those are the issues. But technically, there's great technology, way better than, of course, the ones we have were all built a long time ago, and they're old technology. The new ones you build would be much more efficient and much safer. So it's just political will, I think. Yes? Yep? Oh, sure.
In New York State, we have E15 on all the pumps, and all of the gas we have is E15. Now, I checked, and that's not actually considered a real alternative fuel because it has to be either E85 or E95 for it to actually make a difference. And I'm curious as to if some states that I'm from are already using E15, is it just the lack of corn that's making it hard to actually switch completely to E95? In some states, like my state, are already using E15. What's the problem?
So the question is about ethanol gasoline blends. You know, if a lot of it is and really most of it today is E10, why not E85 or E90 or E100? What's in the way of that? I mean, today, for sure, the answer is there's not enough ethanol. So the amount of ethanol used today across the United States or made today compared to the amount of gasoline we use is about 5%. So if you put ethanol in all the gasoline we use, it'd make 5% blend or E5. So you could double the amount of ethanol we make and still only be at E10 if you used it everywhere. You could triple it and make E15 everywhere. I think by the time you double or triple it or even go to 20%, it's probably about all the ethanol we could make for quite a long time. So I actually personally don't see a lot to gain from E85 or 90 because, you know, to make a gallon of E85, you've got to unmake 7 gallons of E10. I mean, the amount of ethanol is kind of fixed. The other big issue we face, though, is that ethanol, to get it blended in gasoline, you have to move it separately from the gasoline. So gasoline moves from refineries where it's made to places called terminals or depots that have big tanks, and those tanks are used then to load trucks that take it to the gas station where you buy it. From the refinery to the tank, it moves in a pipeline, which is a really, really cheap way to move a liquid, to pump through a pipe. Ethanol can't go through the pipes. So you have to take the ethanol in barges or trucks or rail cars, and you have to take it all the way to the terminal, and then you blend it at the last minute when it goes in the truck to go to the gas station. To do that, you add new hardware. And so in cities and states where it's been mandated, all that hardware is installed. In places where it's not been mandated, that hardware is not installed. And so there's a cost that goes with that. I expect, though, you'll see it happening virtually everywhere before long. So, if we got to the point where we had the green bar of the really high amount of biomass you could make, and we were trying to make all that into ethanol, then you'd have to go to higher blends. But I think the more likely outcome is that by the time we're that good at making something out of that much biomass, we'll probably be good at making something better than ethanol to use. Chances are. Okay? Yep.
I was just curious as to why sugarcane ethanol was about half the price of corn ethanol.
Okay, fair question. Why is sugar ethanol so much cheaper than corn ethanol? Really, it is because in sugar, you can actually squeeze the sugar out of the sugarcane, so you have a stream of essentially pure sugar to put in to convert. And that's what the bugs eat. So they'll eat all the sugar. When you take corn, you know, corn has cellulose, it has germ, it has starch. And so you have to break the starch apart into sugar, and then the bugs will eat that sugar, but they won't eat the husk, and they won't eat the oil, and they won't eat the other parts of the corn. So in a sugar plant, you can make almost all that sugar into ethanol, and then actually the stuff that's left over at the end, you can burn for the heat for the plant. So it's just very efficient. In corn, you actually take a kernel of corn, and about a third of that kernel of corn winds up as ethanol, and about a third of it winds up as animal feed. That's the part that the yeast can't digest actually gets eaten by cows. So it gets used. And the other third is CO2 that's released back from the plant. So that's kind of the weight balance. So that's why. It's just a much more efficient, and you don't have a lot of waste products and byproducts and a lot less material handling. Go. You get a turn.
Thanks for coming. I was wondering if you could describe the interest of big oil companies with respect to alternative energy research and investment.
Well, I can describe BP's, since that's where I worked. And I think you probably see a variety of approaches from a variety of oil companies. BP, I would say, among the oils, was probably the most interested in alternatives from a research and development standpoint. And even from an investment standpoint, in terms of owning businesses that were big for the size of the industry they were in. So, for instance, BP, which a lot of people probably don't know, is the largest single manufacturer of solar photovoltaics. So we're big in the photovoltaic business as a business, but inside BP, that business was tiny. Because if you compare the oil business to the photovoltaic business, the scales are vastly different. BP has invested in a program with DuPont it's a program I helped to manage that is aimed at using genetic engineering to make butanol instead of ethanol as a fuel molecule. And so that's spent a lot of money on that. It's very long range. You can go find some results in the patent literature that are kind of interesting, and the rest I can't talk about. But it's a significant program. The other thing you may have seen publicity about is we have established a institute that's affiliated with UC Berkeley and the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, $50 million a year for 10 years, so $500 million invested in essentially biology for energy kinds of issues. And a lot of the focus of that will be on taking non-food plants and making fuel out of them. So it's a very heavy focus on biofuels. BP is also really big in the wind business, wind turbines. But all of those businesses, if you add them all together, is just a drop in the bucket compared to what BP spends on finding and producing crude oil and refining it. Because the energy business is very heavily fossil, and the business is huge. It's just a huge business. I would say Shell has been around a lot in the alternatives area as well, and are doing some good work from the little bit that I know. Since I don't actually work inside Shell, I don't know, but what you see on the outside. ExxonMobil, I would say, conversely, has said very clearly, our strategy is that the world is for a long time going to need fossil-based fuel, crude oil production, crude oil refining, and fossil fuels. And that's what we do, and so we're going to do that better than anybody else, and other people can do this other stuff. And that's their strategy. A lot of people look at them and say, ooh, bad. I'm not sure if that's bad. It's just a different choice. As long as somebody's working on this, I think it's okay. And if... if the focus that they have kind of makes BP not do as much crude oil and BP does more alternatives, I mean, maybe that's an okay answer. Don't know. But if, you know, if you like what BP is doing, buy BP gas, that, you know, it's okay with me. So I still have some stock. But BP did believe that it was, or does believe, didn't change because I left, does believe that alternatives are, at some point, going to be as big a part of the business as crude oil. It's just when. That isn't obvious. If you don't care if the company lasts more than 20 or 30 years, you don't have to worry about it. And realistically, I mean, just like I kind of made fun of our political cycle that's 2 to 4 years long, you know, management of big company cycles aren't a lot longer than that. They're maybe 7 years, you know, maybe 10. So that, you know, again, the same sort of, to keep something going across 30 years to where it can really make a difference is a hard thing to do, be it for a government or for a company. Sure.
You mentioned that there's a lot of other biofuels besides ethanol. Is your company involved in researching that?
So actually, the company I work for now, just to give you a sense of scale, has 30 people in it. And then we have some contractors that are working for us to build our first plant to make ethanol in California. So as little companies go, what you have to do first is you have to get on your feet and you have to get profitable and you have to have a base to build from. So right now we're very focused on just getting a couple of things up and going. And certainly no apologies for that. I mean, you have to start someplace. The interest and strategy of the company is to stay on the leading edge of biofuel production. So the plant we're building in California is far more efficient than any of the other ethanol plants that exist in the U.S. today. And the idea is then to be in a position where we can be the commercializer of technologies that become usable in a profit-making business. There's an awful lot of technology work being done by government labs, by government-funded private labs, by universities. I mean, there's some really great work going on at the universities today, both on the biology side and the energy side of a lot of this. And all that will lead to things that are commercializable in the future. Most of that work is not being funded by little companies like the one that I work for now because we just can't afford it. But we'll be there to commercialize it when it's closer to being something that can be done at a profit. Yes. Public transportation would make a big difference, you betcha. I mean, it's way, way more efficient for everybody to get on the train to go downtown than for everybody to drive their own car downtown. It's particularly efficient when the facilities to do it already exist. So I live in Chicago. Chicago is great for public transportation because the city grew after the trains were there. So all the spokes of the trains going out from downtown is where the population is. So you can get to the train and you get downtown really easy. If you try to do that same thing in Houston or L.A., it's a big problem because the people are just kind of scattered all over the place. And, you know, public transportation to be efficient has to bundle all the people into one place and then move them all together wherever they're going. You know, airplanes are pretty efficient when they're full of people for going long distances. So I think, yeah, public transportation would make a big difference. It absolutely would. It's politically it's tough, right? People like their own car. I mean, they like the freedom and flexibility of coming and going when they want, and not making sure they were there for the 5:09. And if you missed it, oops, you know, now I got to get the 5:40. I lived in that world for a while, and it's actually fine and good, but it does keep you to a schedule. It's kind of something that people don't talk a lot about now, is it? Public transportation, not as much as they did 30 years ago. Yeah.
You mentioned a little bit earlier that there are incentives that the government can provide to energy companies to do things that, you know, benefit the environment. Can you describe sort of the ideal relationship between the state and energy companies?
Actually, I think, you know, the ideal way to make this work, my view, is as much as you can to let the marketplace drive people's behavior, because that way they don't feel so coerced, and to put in place the kinds of policies and incentives and taxes and whatever else that send the right signals into the marketplace so that people make decisions that actually reflect the true costs of what those decisions are. So, you know, in this country, we have this infrastructure that we've built across the last 50 years, all based on really, really cheap energy. And the best way for me to think about fixing that is actually to change that cost. And you can't change it fast because you know, people's lives get upset, and the demand is very inelastic, and people have to get to work and stuff like that. So you'd have to do it slowly. So again, you got this long time constant thing. But having a long-term strategic vision out of our government of how they want energy to relate to our economy in a different way than it does today, where it's not so cheap and disposable, but actually is a dear commodity, which really it ought to be, and it needs to be eventually, to get there from today gradually across 30 years, to me feels like a sort of a no-brainer government policy. I mean, you don't hear people talking about that much in the current election cycle, but you know, if I was the king, that's what I'd do. I'd tell everybody, you know what, crude oil's $100 today, it's never going down. So, you know, plan your lives accordingly. And by the way, it's going to go up a dollar a year forever. So 100 years from now, it'll be $200 a barrel, you know, in kind of that day's dollars. So, you know, what a plus inflation. You know, that's a long enough time constant that, A, people who are buying stuff because they can afford to buy stuff can adjust their lives, and people who actually are very hurt by that because they don't have enough money for the basic things, you can put programs in place that address that, I would think. So, and you know, so now what you'll see, I'm an engineer, right? So you give me a problem, you know, I can write it down, do the math, solve the problem. How hard is that? Nothing to it. I mean, politically, I can't imagine somebody coming out in this election cycle saying, actually, what I'm for is we're going to put in place kind of a tax that taxes fossil carbon, and it keeps the price of energy high. So all you people who remember cheap gas, too bad, forget it, it's gone. And then we're going to ramp that up over time. So not only is it not going to go back to being cheaper, it's going to get more expensive, because that's really what we need to do to make kind of the whole Earth, not just the U.S., but I mean the whole world, be in a better place. I mean, I can't imagine that person winning in Iowa or New Hampshire or Florida, right? Whatever. So, you know, what you get is more short-term steps. And so there's still things you can do short-term steps. I mean, to me, if we are going to do anything about climate, we have about CO2. If you assume that the CO2 is the driver of the climate change and you want to do something about it, you got to start now, and you got to put in some cost associated with releasing CO2 to the atmosphere. And you know, there's different ways to do it, but you got to do it, because if there's no cost, you know, then I'll put it in the atmosphere. Why not? I'll take one more if you want, or you can cut it off. It doesn't, you know, I've got no place to go. Well, you guys probably do.
Yeah, so as there's more and more demand for corn, do you see the negative side effects of all the extra corn growth being an issue at some point?
Right, so the side effects of high demand for corn, one, the price of corn's gone up. You know, my whole life, corn is like $2 a bushel or $2.50 maybe. Today it's $3.75. So if you're a corn farmer, it's good times. But if you you know, if you eat Fritos, the price of them is going to go up. If you are a person at the poverty level in Mexico and a lot of your diet is corn, it gets to be pretty serious for you, something like that. So that's one. Corn farming is relatively demanding of water and nitrogen fertilizer. I think those are solvable, what I showed you up here with the plant genetics. Now, as long as you're not going to eat the corn, you just want to grow starch, you can probably grow it with a lot less nitrogen and a lot less water by genetically engineering the plant to make fuel as opposed to make food. So I think those are addressable. Same thing with really with the price of corn. I saw an article the other day in, I don't remember what paper it was now, that Heinz, right, biggest ketchup maker, Heinz has gone out and with Monsanto or one of the people that do this, they've re-engineered their tomatoes so that the tomatoes are sweeter, so that they don't have to buy as much corn syrup to put in their ketchup. Okay. So, and of course, that then reduces demand for corn syrup, which reduces demand for corn. One of the things that's gone on with corn here is you had kind of a one-year big change in demand, and so you get a big spike in price. That happens when you change the demand for anything. Those of you who are economists, right, you know what that looks like. It'll damp back out, would be my expectation. Same thing, you know, as water gets more expensive, you know, plants that use less water will become more affordable. As nitrogen fertilizer is more expensive, and so you got to put a price on these things to cause people to change what they do. I mean, the other way, of course, is mandates, and in the end, if you try to do everything through mandate, you wind up with kind of centrally planned economy, right? So there have been a number of experiments in that way, and most of them don't work that well. Yeah, actually, the only reason companies do things mostly is because it's making money for them. So, yes, making ethanol right now is actually not a terribly great business. I mean, you can make a living, but it's not great. Blending ethanol into gasoline is a good thing to do right now financially because ethanol costs less than gasoline. And when you sell it to people at the pump, so when you buy gasoline with ethanol in it, you're actually buying less energy because the ethanol only has about two-thirds of the energy of gasoline per gallon, but you pay the same. And so when you buy E10, you don't pay 3% less per gallon, even though there's 3% less energy in there. And so it's a profitable thing to do, and people, where you can, where the infrastructure is in place to do it, people are blending it as much as they can. Now, your question was also about what's the government doing. The government's actually funding an awful lot of research and development programs around not just ethanol, but all sorts of alternative energy. And eventually, some of those will come up with good stuff. And the government's kind of a shotgun. I mean, they'll fund a lot of stuff, and a lot of it won't amount to anything. Some of it will be good. And you can't ever tell at the start what's going to be the stuff that really is good and works. Right? And that's, I have a big sign... had a big sign when I was in charge of the research stuff at BP. I had a big sign on my wall that said, if we knew what we were doing, it wouldn't be research, which is really true. When you start off, you don't actually know. Yeah.
The response you just gave to that question actually just made me think about it.
Good.
You said that when you buy gas with ethanol enrichment, you're actually getting less energy. Does that mean you need to buy more gas or you're putting more CO2 into the atmosphere?
Well, the CO2 that comes from the ethanol, see, is really ethanol from the plant, so you're not putting anything out from that. So, yeah. So, but the amount of energy you need to drive from here to there is a fixed amount of BTUs. If you buy that BTUs in gasoline, that gasoline puts a given amount of carbon out. If you buy it in ethanol, you need to buy more gallons of ethanol, but it puts out carbon that comes from the plant. So really, net, you're ahead for CO2, but you're behind for your wallet if we're charging the same per gallon. Maybe I haven't said it very clearly. I could do the math for you. But trust me, the ethanol part in your car, as long as the ethanol isn't making the car run more poorly, which it doesn't, you just have to squirt more in through your fuel injection system to make it work, if that answers your question. Actually, I mean, just to follow that up, my mind will wander 100 different ways, and you can tell us when it's time to stop. One of the things that's good about ethanol is it's very high octane. So the gasoline you buy at the pump, you know, you see the numbers, 87, 89, 92, or 93, or whatever. That's the octane rating of the fuel. Ethanol is like 110, 115. And if you knew that you would always run only ethanol in an engine, you could tune that engine to be much more efficient, because you can run at a much higher compression ratio and thus higher temperature without detonation in the engine, which is knocking, right? That's what the octane is prevents. But that's kind of a chicken and egg thing. You have to have the ethanol to be able to fill up on, and the car makers have to know that there's enough people to buy those kind of cars, and so it's kind of a bootstrap, hard to get started thing. But it, you could do it, and it would make a difference. You know, if you added up everything we spend on alternatives, maybe it's a couple of $100 million a year, a few $100 million a year. Now, I know, I mean, you sit here in the room and think, holy moly, that's a lot of money, right? But we spend like 10, 15 billion a year just looking for oil and you know, new oil and producing new fields. I mean, one of the things that's just true about the oil business is it is just so big. The numbers are just stunning. And so even a few $100 million a year, which is a lot of money for most businesses, I mean, for BP is kind of the third column of zeros in the annual report, right? They don't even count the money that close, the stock analyst. Absolutely, you bet.
So that money,
yeah.
Is it going in the pockets? Is it going to find more oil? How would they react if the government had a windfall profit tax, or if they mandated that they spend this X percentage on
alternatives? Yeah. I mean, you could do that. I mean, and so if you're the government, you want to say, look, you're making so much money, it's unconscionable. We're going to take that money away from you, and we're going to spend it in a smarter way. Or we're going to make you spend it in a smarter way. You can do it. I mean, my own experience with that is the government's actually not real good at picking the right things to invest in, and not very efficient at spending the money. Whereas companies, because they have a profit incentive motive, are actually pretty efficient and pretty ruthless about trimming out the stuff that isn't working too well. The reason that oil companies spend almost all of their earnings investing back into finding oil is because it's the most profitable thing they can do still, because that's the most profitable business. If you want to change that, you have to change the cost and profit picture somehow. And so, I mean, what you're proposing is a way. And I guess, I would say as much as you can, it would be great to let the market pick the winners for technology. But you do have to somehow put in place a cost that relates to the things that we want to move away from. And so what you propose, I think, conceptually is the right idea. I mean, I might do it a different way. Yeah?
These days, things are getting greener because people care about green and political pressure. And that's why things change. What about the social aspects? So you've got people, say, in Africa being paid $1 a day to cut their shoe cane. One day people are going to care enough about that to start that changing, in which case, like, where do we go with energy has these effects, like, if you give example, people make.
Yeah. So if your question is, do I think people will one day somehow change their psyche and care more about people living thousands of miles away from them than they care about themselves? No, I don't think so. I mean, sorry, but I don't think so. But what people will do, I think, is they'll get together collectively, and they'll try to do something that seems moral and just and fair, if they feel like everybody else is going to play by moral and just and fair rules. So, I mean, I think maybe it's a little naive, but I do think that's how change can happen. But one of the things I will tell you is, I mean, we have repeatedly done the experiment where we've tried to go sell a fuel that is demonstrably better for the environment. And you cannot charge a penny a gallon for that. Even if you can show people, here's the data, it will show you your car will put less CO2 into the atmosphere, it'll put less NOx, it'll put less whatever. know, here's the pamphlet, here's the experiments. We promise, and we've demonstrated, people will not even pay a penny for that today. So now, everyone, if you call and ask them, will say they'll pay a nickel. Right? But if you just put it on the street, and people have a choice, and they can go to BP and pay a penny more, or they can go to Citgo and not, they go to Citgo. Now, not everybody. There's a few, you know, people that are really, really committed to something that they care about, and they'll put their money there, but not enough to make a difference to a big company like ours. Yeah, sure. Right, or three more. I don't care.
Someone who had corn-based ethanol in the United States. What do you think? Do you think that corn has become such a prime source of ethanol due to historical farm subsidies since the 1970s that encouraged overproduction of corn as agricultural products?
Actually, corn ethanol has been around for a really long time at small volumes, and the thing that really got corn ethanol going happened a few years ago. There are government mandates that for gasoline in places that have environmental problems, you have to put part of the blend has to be a molecule with oxygen in it, okay? And that actually helps the combustion process and makes the pollution lower from the car. There were two choices of the kind of molecule you could use. One was an ether molecule called MTBE. Don't know if anybody's heard of that. That was a molecule that was made in refineries, a refining process offshoot from crude oil refining. And it was the molecule of choice for a long time. But it turns out that it is a molecule that when you spill gasoline, it migrates into the groundwater and stays a kind of a long time, and it turned out to be an environmental problem. And the other molecule you could use was ethanol. So for a really long time, all the gasoline in the areas that required an oxygenated component used MTBE. But as soon as the environmental issues became more clear and the liability behind those environmental issues started to become clear to the people that make gasoline, that is the big oil companies, they backed away from MTBE, stopped using it, and the only other choice was ethanol. And so that caused what has happened lately is this huge rise, dramatic increase in ethanol production was to meet that. The farm subsidies and all that, I mean, I actually am not an expert on the farm side of this, but it is clearly a set of programs that probably are not achieving all the things that we would like them to do. And I mean, there's big transfer payments into big corporate farms, and you kind of wonder, who's that helping?
Yeah.
We're out of time. No, it's okay. One more.
Steve, you're going to have to point on our side. You were talking to a group of bright young people who were about to start their careers. And they wanted to change the world for the better and maybe make some money, too.
Oh, boy. We were talking about this a little bit in the car. Paul and I were talking about this. To me, if you actually want to be part of changing the world, and you're not all that picky about whether you get fabulously rich doing it, then science, engineering, and technology is the place to do that, because that's where the big step changes come from. They don't come from the next bond float. Right? I mean, you got to have that stuff. I mean, people got to have money, and the money's got to move around and whatever, but that doesn't make it happen. Technology careers are the places where big changes are really made from. And if you want to make a big difference, that's where I'd say you do it. But it can be frustrating. It can be hard. It's in this country, technology capability is either taken for granted or not always valued. So it's kind of a personal choice there. We were talking, my daughter for the last 2 years is doing Teach for America, so that's another one. You can kind of make a personal difference, but you don't get paid a lot for it. I have very much enjoyed my time in a career that's partly technology and partly running businesses. And I would say it's a place where you can make a big difference for sure. How's that? Okay.
I love breaking up a Q&A session where people are just like continuing to ask questions. That's great.
That's great. Well, thanks, Greg. Thank you. Great questions.
Guys, thanks for coming out. Is there a motion for a recess?